Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today we will be interviewing Professor Stone, Edward H. Levi Distinguished Service Professor of Law of University of Chicago Law School. He has authored many books on constitutional law, many of which address the First Amendment. Professor Stone was also appointed by President Obama to serve on the President's Review Group on Intelligence and Communications Technologies to evaluate intelligence surveillance programs. I am Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. So, Professor Stone, could you introduce yourself a little bit more?
Thank you for having me, Ken. I have been a professor at the University of Chicago Law School for almost half a century. I've served as dean of the law school and as provost of the university. And way back in 1972-73, I was a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice William J. Brennan, Jr. And as you said, most of my work has been, most of my research has been in the areas of free speech and freedom of the press. I published a number of books in that area. In recent years, Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, who clerked at the Supreme Court the same year I did, he was the Justice Warren Brennan, Chief Justice Warren Brennan. I'm sorry, he was the Chief Justice Warren Burger at the same time I was with William Brennan. And so we've known each other for basically half a century. And we put together a number of books together, including most recently, it came out 2 weeks ago, the book on social media, freedom of the press, and social media, freedom of speech, and the future of our democracy. And this book, like several others we've done, consists of introductions by us, and then a collection of somewhere between 16 and 20 essays by very distinguished individuals, law scholars, people from the media, people from government, and so on. And then we have a, quote, commission at the end that reviews all the essays and makes a set of recommendations based upon the views expressed in the essays. So in addition to that book, the social media book, we have done books on the free speech century, which basically marked the 100th anniversary of the Supreme Court's first decision on the meaning of the First Amendment. We've done one on national security, freedom of the press, and the Pentagon Papers case. I've written a number of books independently on the First Amendment, including Perilous Times, Free Speech in Wartime, from the Sedition Act of 1798 to the War on Terror. And I've also written books on other subjects like sex and the Constitution and so on. In this particular book, Lee and I were obviously interested in bringing together a group of very interesting and knowledgeable and impressive people to express their views on what we consider to be one of the major challenges of our current moment, and that is the impact of social media on public opinion, on democracy, and on the First Amendment. In terms of the review group that President Obama appointed me to, I had known Obama for a while. When I was dean of the law school, I appointed Obama a lecturer in the law school, and we became friends in those years. After the Snowden leaks, Obama decided he wanted to put together, sorry, I got a cold. After the Snowden leaks, Obama decided he wanted to put together a group of five individuals who would constitute the review group that would examine particularly NSA programs, some of which had been released by Snowden, to evaluate and make recommendations as to whether they can and should in any significant way be changed. It was a fascinating experience. It was entirely top secret. We met regularly with the president and with the head of the CIA, the head of the NSA, head of the FBI, and with many media groups and so on, civil liberties organizations, and published a report called the NSA Report that looked through a range of NSA programs and made some serious recommendations for how those programs could be improved so as to protect the privacy and security of individuals to a greater degree than was being protected before. So those are the kind of things that I've been doing over the years.
Professor Stone, you seem to have a lot of experience evaluating a lot of work dealing with the First Amendment, and you are evaluating what to do with that speech, including hate speech, disinformation, and propaganda, with the backdrop of new technologies in the past, such as the rise of television and radio. We have had a federal agency to deal with issues relating to the regulation of communications. However, with the rising of newer social platforms like Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, YouTube, and more, what do you think we should be doing to ensure a just and equal society for our future?
Well, there's at least two ways of approaching that. From the standpoint of the First Amendment, I strongly agree with the court's conclusions that speech can be restricted in our democracy only in extraordinary circumstances. And the court did not start that way. When they first decided its initial case about the First Amendment, it upheld the convictions of individuals who had protested or criticized World War I on the ground that they might have the effect of leading individuals to refuse induction into the military, which was, you know, a pretty remote effect. But the court said, well, the First Amendment doesn't go that far. Over the next 50 years, and indeed over the next century, the court has evolved its jurisprudence so as to recognize that, first of all, in a free and open society, and democracy in particular, it is essential that individuals be able to state what they believe and to make their arguments to others, and not to have the government intervening and policing what they say, even if the majority of people believe what they're saying is wrong or harmful. Because many of the things we once believed to be wrong, we have over time concluded to be right. A good example is gay rights, but there are lots of others as well, where people have come to understand that the views they held in the past just were wrong, and that they had to have an open mind. So understanding that has led the court and certainly led me to embrace a very aggressive understanding of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. Social media has complicated that in a number of ways. First of all, social media, as it has developed, has had an enormous impact on the information and ideas that individuals have access to. Part of the problem, frankly, is that social media companies use algorithms to send individuals posts that they know those individuals will like. They want people to use Facebook or Twitter or whatever as much as possible because that's how they make their revenue from advertising. And the more times people look at their sites, the more money they make. And therefore, the best way to get people to look at their sites is to send them things that reinforce what they already believe to be true. And the consequence of that has been a serious polarization of views in the United States. So people on the left basically only receive, of the billions of posts that are out there, they only receive the 100 that tend to either be their family or to reinforce what they already believe. And the same is true, of course, on the right. And the consequence of that has been, as I said, to polarize the democracy in ways that are not healthy and in some ways are worse than we've ever encountered, or at least potentially going to be worse than we've ever encountered. And I do think it's important in a democracy for people to have open minds and for people to be able to listen to one another and to think about the views of those who disagree with them. And social media has cut the other way in a very dramatic sense. That's one of the key challenges of social media to democracy today. Another one is the fact that it has so much power to spread bad information, hate speech, false speech, and the like, that in the past, although people didn't like hate speech, it did not have a broad impact, except maybe in the South, in the years leading up to Brown v. Board of Education and so on, in the Jim Crow era. But basically, the kind of hate speech we see now throughout most of the nation most of the time was relatively modest in terms of the number of people who were exposed to it. But with social media and with the algorithms, it is far more capacious and is having arguably far greater effect in distorting the views of American citizens. And this creates real problems. So there are several questions here. One of them is there a way for the government to regulate social media so as to reduce these and related problems that currently exist? And second, to what extent, if the government does try to do that, would it be consistent with the First Amendment? Now, when social media first came into existence, Congress, in the 1996 Communications Decency Act, adopted Section 230. Section 230 provides that social media companies, unlike radio stations, television stations, newspapers, cable TV, and you and I, are immune from liability for what individuals post on their sites. So if the New York Times posts a letter to the editor that is in fact defamatory of an individual, they can be held liable for having posted it. And if CBS posts information that is obscene, they can be held liable for violating obscenity laws, even though they were not the ones who created it. And that continues to this day. But with social media, Congress decided that the vision for social media was not to have these companies pick and choose what posts would be allowed to be circulated and distributed to people, but to make this the equivalent of an amazing open field in which all individuals would have the freedom to post essentially whatever they like without the interference of the internet companies. Now, they could be held liable if you post something that is a threat under the law, or if you post something that is libelous under the law, you could be held liable for doing so. But Facebook and Twitter cannot, unlike the New York Times and the Washington Post and ABC. And so the reason for that was Congress did not want social media to have to review everything everybody posts every day to avoid liability from their standpoint. A newspaper, a magazine, TV station can only allow a small amount of information, and they therefore can review the information in advance without it being an undue burden. But for social media to have to do that would be almost impossible, and it would destroy the capacity and the potential of social media to be this amazing new venue in which you and I and everybody else can simply write whatever we think and have it be seen by our friends, and have they consented to their friends. And social media would not have to be intervening in any of that. That has created real problems that were not anticipated, in part because social media has become so powerful, and because the media companies, using their algorithms, have had such a negative impact on our democracy, that the question is, what, if anything, can we do about this consistent with the First Amendment? And that was the basic question that was at the focus of the book that Lee Bollinger and I just published on social media, freedom of speech, and the future of our democracy. Is there any way to regulate this that would do more good than harm, and that would be consistent with the First Amendment? And the danger is, if you give the government too much power, you run into all of the risks that otherwise exist with giving government too much power. Government officials will likely use their power to benefit themselves. They will silence those whose speech they don't like, and they will allow those to speak whose views they do like. not because those views are protected or not protected by the First Amendment, but they would simply be inevitably discriminatory. And so the challenge to figure out, is there a way to maintain the vibrancy of social media, which does have real value for individuals, but at the same time to constrain some of the seriously damaging effects it is having on our society and on our democracy. And that was the challenge of this book. So one thing you mentioned a moment ago is creating an agency analogous to the Federal Communications Commission, which was established after the advent of radio and television. So when radio and television entered the picture, there were only a few, maybe two or three frequencies in any given city, like Chicago or New York or Los Angeles or whatever. And Congress was afraid that if this was part of a free market, one or two very wealthy people could buy all the frequencies and dominate what individuals in those communities heard in a way that didn't exist before. There used to be lots of newspapers, and people could choose among, you know, in a city like Chicago, 15 different newspapers. That's not true anymore. But with radio and television, the fear was that a single entity could buy up all the radio stations or TV stations in New York or California or Chicago and completely dominate public debate and discussion. So Congress decided to create the Federal Communications Act, which essentially said that these frequencies have to be licensed by the government. And the government will give a license only to entities that agree to abide by the rules provided in the Fairness Doctrine. And what the Fairness Doctrine provided is that a radio or TV station had to provide fair and balanced presentation of views. It could not be distinctively ideological. It could not be Republican or Democratic or communist or Nazist. It had to be essentially moderate and even-headed. And that program, that policy, had, I think, a great deal of positive impact for much of the 20th century. When I grew up, for example, in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, radio and television were fair and balanced. If you watched, you know, CBS or NBC or ABC, or listened to similar radio stations, they were not ideological. They tended to present people on both sides of questions. The commentators tended to be fair and neutral. And that gave Americans a reasonably thoughtful understanding of political issues. Now, there were, of course, critics, but fundamentally, they were doing their job in a reasonably responsible way. And it benefited, I think, American democracy. By the 1980s, the Reagan administration decided to get rid of the Fairness Doctrine. And even though most over-the-air television stations still seem to act in the culture of the Fairness Doctrine, that's certainly not true of radio stations anymore. And the Fairness Doctrine doesn't apply to cable or to the internet and the like. So we now live in a world in which, you know, with things like Fox News, which didn't exist back when I was growing up, and even worse, what goes on social media, we're having this polarization and radicalization of our democracy, which is not a healthy thing. So the question is, what can you do about it? So one thing is the government create a similar agency, like the Federal Communications Commission, to oversee all of social media and require social media companies to be fair and balanced in the way they present individuals with information. So instead of you're getting only posts that reinforce your views, because that's in the economic interest of the social media company, they would have an obligation to send you views on all sides of issues. And you might not like that at first, but hopefully it would have a positive impact and avoid the kind of polarization that we now face. That would be a pretty dramatic step. Partly because social media is so complex and so large and so international that to have the equivalent of the Federal Communications Commission overseeing it would be an enormous challenge. But that's one of the possibilities that one might try to figure out how to make it work and to take away what is currently the freedom of social media entities to provide citizens with information that winds up distorting their views and radicalizing their views. We do not, in this book, recommend that we go that far yet. We recommend more modest suggestions. One of them is a notice and takedown policy, which essentially says that in order to have Section 230 immunity, social media outlets must create a process whereby if an individual files a complaint with the social media organization, that a particular post is not protected by the First Amendment. But they must, then as a social media company, must then have a process by which they review that complaint in a fair manner. And if they conclude that the complainant is correct, take down the post. Then that would apply only to material that's not protected by the First Amendment, which is a small category of speech. But at least it would eliminate some of the most extreme forms of speech on the internet. And if they refuse to do that or don't do it responsibly, they would lose Section 230 immunity, which would be terribly destructive. So no internet company is going to want to lose that. So this should give them an enormous incentive to participate in such a program. It's not as aggressive and demanding as saying you have to review every single post that anyone puts up, or you can be held liable, like a newspaper, for any illegal or civilly actionable post. But this says at least when someone brings to your attention a post that they believe to be illegal or not protected, then you have to review that claim quickly and responsibly and remove the post if you conclude that it was not protected. The second recommendation we make along these lines is called a self-regulatory organization, an SRO. This would not be government-run. It would be a private organization that internet companies would have to participate in order to retain Section 230 immunity. And what it would do would basically be to bring together experts from academia, from philosophy, from internet world experts, from government, who would review the policies of the companies and advise them about what they should and should not take down beyond what the First Amendment would not protect. And this might include, for example, things like hate speech and things like false political statements that are protected by the First Amendment. And the government would not be requiring them to do that, but it would say if you don't cooperate with this self-regulatory organization, you would lose Section 230 immunity. So those are the kind of recommendations that the authors in this volume came up with. Now, whether they could be enacted, whether a court would find them to be constitutional, those are complicated questions. These do intrude on the autonomy of these entities. But Section 230 was not required by the First Amendment. No other journalist or communicative organization has Section 230. So government could remove that anytime it wants to without violating the First Amendment. So this is saying we've given you a privilege. If you want to retain that privilege, you have to be responsible. And these are the ways in which we think you should be responsible.
And Professor Stone, to address your second point of establishing an SRO to limit or fight against disinformation, do you believe that that organization might be Orwellian in a way, essentially creating a ministry of truth where you're taking away people's speech and rights to freedom of speech, because, you know, as it currently stands, there is a marketplace of ideas. There is a freedom of speech on the internet. But if we start, you know, having that SRO, don't you think that, you know, these academias, these philosophers will be able to possess the ability to take down certain speech or force companies to, you know, pick and choose what they want to post?
Well, the notion of the SRO is for them, A, not to be politicized. The idea is to have the people who participate in it to be across ideological bounds and political bounds, number one. So hopefully they would not, like the Federal Communications Commission, they would not be politically partisan in order to function. That's part of the hope. And the Federal Communications Commission did a good job at that. And the idea is to somehow replicate the appointment of individuals from all sides of political and social attitudes, Republicans and Democrats and the like, and that they would have to act in a reasonably neutral way. If they didn't do that, then you're right, it could be terribly destructive. And that's not the idea. The idea is to point these entities in a way that they would be non-political, non-ideological. And again, they would not be requiring the social media companies to do what they say. The social media companies could say, no, we're not going to do that, but they would lose Section 230 immunity, which they have no right to, right? The First Amendment does not require Section 230 immunity. It would be as if the government was providing financial subsidies to all newspapers and said that you lose the financial subsidy if you engage in speech that is deemed to be harmful to the nation, determined in a reasonably neutral manner. Now, that would be complicated. I'm not saying that's an easy First Amendment question. For the government to take away a privilege from individuals because their speech is seen as inappropriate is a tricky and potentially dangerous business. You're absolutely right to raise the question. But the idea is to have an SRO consist of people who are, as I said, neutral and not highly ideological, and, you know, looking to basically improve the public discourse on the internet in a responsible manner, without seeking to silence speech because of its ideological content.
So what if there were folks from one side of the ideological bent that wanted to silence or limit a particular form of speech because, you know, it could be, let's say, expensive disinformation or hate speech. And in that case, do we appeal to that ideological side, or how do we remain neutral and how do we remain moderate? And even remaining moderate is also, you know, an ideology in and of itself, right?
So, well, the idea is if you have enough people on the commission who come from different perspectives, both ideologically and their own personal backgrounds and expertise, and they can only act if, say, two-thirds of them agrees to take a position, then you can significantly reduce the risk. And of course, if it doesn't work, you can eliminate it or change it. But I don't think it's impossible to put something like that together if you take steps to appoint people to it in a neutral manner, in an even-handed manner, where both Republicans and Democrats are able to appoint some people, where people who are not particularly ideological at all are able to appoint people when they agree on who should be appointed. That's part of the challenge, right, is to figure out how to get a reasonably neutral group. And it may not be something one could really achieve, but I don't think it's impossible to do that. It really depends on how you go about the appointment process. And I've certainly seen situations where you could appoint people in a university, for example, who are pretty neutral on ideas. Or even if they disagree, there are enough people who take the range of ideas that no one side is able to dominate. And that would be the goal, to appoint a commission that has that viewpoint, that set of attitudes. Whether it worked or not remains to be seen. But again, the idea is that you can always eliminate it if it's not working right. Right? Its existence is not required by the First Amendment or by anything else in the Constitution. And so the hope is you would do it, for example, for a 5-year experiment period and see how it works. And if it doesn't work, it would expire automatically after 5 years unless a certain percentage of members of Congress or whatever decides to reinstitute it. So there are ways to limit the amount of danger that could be created. But the key point is having neutral appointees, not to have ideological appointees. And that's tricky in today's world where politics is so polarized. And that's why you're looking for people who are not so much political.
And with your idea of this commission, how has this sort of commission similarly functioned in the past? So, for example, in back to the Greek and Roman times, from media all the way to the radio and TV era, how has that fanned out, and how do you think that with the changing landscape of social media, how do you think that would fare out in 5 years? And what is your prediction? And what do you think are the recommendations?
Well, I mean, my prediction is that it will take a lot of more detailed thought than we put into it. We put into it, a recommendation in 10 pages at the end of the volume, right? It wasn't that we thought through all the many complexities. We noted the complexities with the potential problems, but we didn't try to solve them all in this book. And hopefully other people will take this and try to figure out, are there ways to make this work in an appropriate manner and a reliable and safe manner? But the problem is we have to understand that what we now face with social media is, I think all of us on this, who participated in this book, believe to be a serious threat to democracy. That the polarization that these networks, these internet companies are now creating is radical and completely incompatible with a well-functioning democracy. You want people in a democracy to be able to listen to one another, to hear the views on the other side, to keep an open mind, to recognize that the things they believe today may not be right. And that if they hear the other side and think about it, they may change their minds. And that's been true throughout our history in all sorts of ways. But right now, we are in an environment in which that's not the case. So one of the things we recommend, for example, is that the algorithms that the companies use be made public. So at least, at a minimum, people will know that they are being manipulated. Now, many of them won't care. But the fact that they are being manipulated, that they're only receiving points of view that reinforce their own points of view that they've liked in the past, hopefully will upset some people, because it's not necessarily obvious to many people if that's what's happening. And they need to have an understanding of that. And whether you can educate people at this point in time, given how far we've gone already, remains to be seen. A lot of this, too, is about education, is educating people, beginning with kids and going all the way through high school, college, and the public, about the potential dangers of social media as it now exists, and trying to get them to understand that they are being manipulated. And it's not because of the political views of the social media companies. It's because of the economic interests of those companies. And that's not something they should want. Most people should recognize that they don't want to be manipulated in terms of what they read and what they see and what they hear by some other entity for their own economic interests. But the fact is, if you only hear the same point of view over and over and over again, it's likely to have a significant effect on you. And, that's damaging to democracy. But I think you have to weigh the risks on one side against the risks on the other. It's not that there aren't risks with trying to control this. It's that the current risks, I suspect, are greater even than the likely risks that would incur from any of the recommendations that we've come up with.
And let's say that a lot of these algorithms, a lot of these tech companies become public. And many of the algorithms, what they do is, for a lot of consumers, is they track how much someone who uses, let's say, a platform like Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube stays on a particular video, or how many times they click on a video. And based on that, they determine, those are the types of videos and those are the types of media that they'll receive. So what isn't that the consumer's, own doing of staying on those videos, staying, clicking on those articles? The algorithm and these social media companies, what they're doing is they're just feeding what the consumer wants, right? So why should a tech company be incentivized to reveal their algorithm or even limit some of the information that they present to the consumer itself? So what's the incentive and why should they do that?
Because most people don't understand this is what's happening to them. They have no idea that they're being manipulated for the economic interests of the social media companies. And it just doesn't occur to them. They don't think about it. But if they keep seeing the same ideological position over and over and over again, they are likely to become deeply embedded in that position. And I would guess the vast majority of Americans are not aware that they are being manipulated in that way. And hopefully many of them would say, wait a minute, right? I don't want that. Now, they're still free to go and search for the things they want to look at. Nothing prevents them from going and searching on Facebook or whatever for the sites that interest them. But this would say you're not going to get only those sites over and over and over again. So they're still free to look for whatever they want. But the idea is they will be exposed at least to different points of view. And if that had been the case from the beginning with social media, we would have a very different political reality in our country today. I don't think there's any doubt that social media has had a radicalizing and polarizing effect on people. And most of them didn't know this was happening to them. The vast majority of them didn't know this was happening to them. It just never occurred to them that they were being manipulated by the social media companies to make money by sending them the stuff they were most likely to want to see over and over and over again. And again, there are certainly going to be members of our community who say, that's all I want to see. Right? No doubt that's true. But there are also going to be many of them who say, wait a minute, it didn't occur to me. It didn't occur to me, frankly, until we began this project, that that's what was going on. I knew I was seeing posts by my friends and by my relatives, but it didn't occur to me that the ideological things I was seeing were being manipulated by Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I was totally naive about that. And I'm sure that's even more true for the vast majority of Americans. And as you suggest, many of them may say, that's okay with me. But many others will say, wait a minute, that's not healthy. That's not good. I don't want to be manipulated in that way. You know, I want to be able to make up my own mind about it, not to be fed only the same and even constantly more radicalized views over and over and over again. And giving them at least the freedom not to have that happen to them is a good thing. You're not preventing them, again, from searching out whatever they want to see. But at least it wouldn't be automatically sent, that stuff, and they would be sent stuff on the other side. And that's part of the whole notion of free speech and democracy, is that people hear and think about different positions. This was the whole notion for having a robust and wide open freedom of speech, that we don't trust government to control what you hear, and what we've come to realize is we don't trust social media companies because of the power they have to determine what you read and what you see. And I think this is a fundamental precept of free speech in a democracy, that individuals get exposed to a wide range of speech and counter speech. X and not X, that enables them to think about these questions in a reasonably thoughtful and informed manner, rather than to be, in effect, driven into a particular position because they don't realize that they're being manipulated.
And Professor Stone, what are your visions for the future of social media, our democracy, and what can the federal government do? What can the Supreme Court do in the future to respond to the rising tide of social media companies and their new innovations that have much better algorithms, newer innovations and ways to get media to people? What are some of the responses to that?
Well, Congress could take steps like the ones we recommend to lessen the current reality distortion of social media that does, I think, great harm to the functioning of our democracy by polarizing people who don't know that they're being manipulated. That's, I think, critical. What the Supreme Court could do is to uphold the constitutionality of such regulations. Now, I said earlier that the Supreme Court in the Red Lion case in 1969 upheld the Fairness Doctrine as applied to radio and television. It said it did not violate the First Amendment for the government to have a federal agency, the Federal Communications Commission, that would require radio and television to provide fair, balanced, even-handed presentations of political viewpoints. They said, given the power of radio and television, because that was all before the internet, before cable, they held that that was constitutional. Only a few years later, though, when a state adopted a similar law for newspapers, providing that because of the growing demise of the number of newspapers, that in a political campaign, if a newspaper attacked a particular candidate, it had to allow that candidate equal space to respond to the attack. And the Supreme Court held that was unconstitutional. That violated the First Amendment rights of the newspaper. Now, the question is, which of those two models would this Supreme Court embrace with respect to regulations of the internet? It's not clear which way these justices would go, but I would fear that they would follow the second approach and would be potentially inclined to hold unconstitutional regulations of this sort. But that's not at all obvious, and it's not at all clear that there's even a very powerful argument that can be made for that position. But hopefully they would be, hopefully Congress is willing to do these things. To be clear, the SRO is not governed. So that happens, there's no First Amendment issue. That's just private decision making by the social media companies, which is encouraged. Now, again, the court could say you can't take away Section 230 protection if they don't do that. That violates their First Amendment rights not to do that. So a court could easily hold these things unconstitutional. And it's kind of an open question, frankly. But I think, again, the people who participated in this project all were of the view that these are sufficiently compelling problems that we're facing in our society now, at least as great as we faced, at least in the late 60s, when the Red Lion case came before the Supreme Court about radio and television, that hopefully the court would recognize that some ability to regulate this is essential to the future of our democracy. And I don't think they'd be stupid about that. And it's not clear that it necessarily benefits Republicans versus Democrats. It just distorts what individuals see and hear. And that's just not a good thing. And they all understand why we have a First Amendment, the justices.
Well, right now we're about to approach the time for the end of our podcast right here. Thank you again, Professor Stone, for having this wonderful conversation. I just want to thank everyone for listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. Professor Stone, do you have any lasting words before I sign off, everyone?
I mean, only that I think it's really important that we, meaning individuals, academics, government officials, educate people about how they're being manipulated. The vast majority of Americans, I'm quite confident, are not aware of it. And if they were made aware of it, at least some significant percentage of them would say, wait a minute, that's not good. And they could at least then try themselves to alleviate the problem by searching other websites than the ones they're being given. But I do think education, in addition to the kind of regulations we've talked about, is critical to this. People have to understand the importance of hearing both sides of issues, all sides of issues, and to having an open mind, and not to allow themselves to be manipulated in these political ways, even if the reason is not political, it's economic, because it's not what they should want to have happen to them, but it is what's happening to them. So I think people need to be educated about that, and we need to be talking about it more, and students need to understand this better than they do, because they can protect themselves in all sorts of ways by seeking out websites on the other side, which will change the algorithms that go to them. But I do think this is a major challenge for a democracy, and we should not underestimate it.
Yeah, and that's why it's important for people like you and I to have these conversations, our audience to be listening to this. And also, you know, I highly recommend Professor Stone's book on social media, freedom of speech, and the future of our democracy to understand more about this issue. But thank you again for having this conversation. And thank you to everyone for listening to this episode. Next time, we'll have more professors and academics speak on the topics of entrepreneurship, policy, and constitutional rights. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all of your friends to do that as well. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you, Ken. I appreciate it.